Mr. Schulz.
James Buswell formerly was on the faculty at Wheaton College in Anthropology. I think he was chairman of the department at one time. He got his doctorate at St. John's University in New York, and teaching on the faculty there for a while, too. And now he is in the William Carey, Institute or Center out in Pasadena, California.
Thank you. We will be reading James Buswell's paper since he is not here today. I do remember him very well as a student at Wheaton College and enjoyed some of his lectures in a couple of courses that I took. The title is The Image of God in the Nature of Humanity, Transcendence Limited by Cultural Determinism. If there is in conventional anthropology one concept which is central to the definition of human uniqueness, it is culture. And if there is one concept in biblical anthropology central to theological interpretations of human uniqueness, it is his creation in the image of God. I speak intentionally of theological interpretations here because, whereas the Bible unmistakably teaches much about mankind in relation to God, about the roles, relationships, and responsibilities of humans with each other, and the unity and the condition of the human race in relation to history, redemption, and destiny, most of its teaching concerning the distinctive nature of humankind must be inferred from what we know of humankind directly, and in relation to the Bible's differential treatment of animals, humans, angels, demons, and deity. Thus, there is no significant biblical teaching concerning the variety of the racial and so forth physical appearance of human beings, nor concerning the basis for such physical differences, nor concerning the anatomical features which distinguish human from non-humans, nor concerning the cultural, as contrasted with the genetic, basis of human society. From the account of creation, the most that can be said about such human characteristics is that God made the first man and woman out of existing material and gave them life, presumably for the first time. We must fall back on an interpretation of the unique things God says, A, about his creation of the man, let us make man in our image after our likeness, B, about his specified plans and expectations regarding human roles and functions, dominion over nature, responsibilities of reproduction, and instructions regarding the Garden of Eden, and C, the relational emphasis, male and female created he them. Thus, in order to get at the essential nature of mankind, our intention is inevitably drawn back to the enigmatic phrase, the image of God. Now, Berkauer says that the biblical witness regarding man never gives us any kind of systematic theory about man as the image of God. He also quotes Herman Bavinck, who as indicating that the full meaning of the image of God is nowhere unfolded for us. And Karl Barth reviews various explanations of the image of God, concluding that one cannot discuss which of them is the right interpretation of Genesis 1:26, for it is crystal clear that their interpretations were one and all fabricated out of thin air, according to the different anthropologies of the authors, of their authors. So let us make clear our anthropological assumptions. According to the sciences, generally human beings are animals, for they are not plants. However, they are not merely animals in anybody's terms. As we stated at the beginning, the primary factor that distinguishes humans from the rest of the animal world is culture. It is the single most important concept in the science of anthropology. Its usage includes reference to the appreciation for and participation in certain forms of aesthetic, learned, and creative aspects of civilization. However, to the anthropologist, the term culture has a special meaning, which, with its implications, he would like members of all of the disciplines, even the whole world, to understand and appreciate. In the first place, it boils down to the fact that humans, of all the animal world, are born without any behavior-determining instincts common to the species. Other animals of every variety behave throughout their entire lives according to a pattern of behavior provided specifically for the species and inherited genetically. Humans alone inherit nothing except the physical and physiological equipment with which they are born, and must then learn all of their social behavior and the content, meaning, and expectations of their culture from that moment on. This is not to say that non-human animals do not learn. They learn too, and are taught a great deal by their own kind, not to mention what they are sometimes taught by humans. But if matured in isolation and then dropped among other members of their species, their behavior would be relatively complete as compared with a human under the same hypothetical circumstances. A man would have no way of knowing how the newfound members of his species expected him to act. He would not have their customs or values. He would not even communicate with them until he learned how. The proportion of the learned behavior of non-human animals in comparison with their built-in behavior is so different from humans that although it might conceivably amount to a difference in degree, it is more often conceded that the difference is of such a magnitude as to be a difference in kind. For animal species vary, to be sure, in the proportion of learning which contributes to their total behavior. But there are no societies of people anywhere who have a lesser proportion of learned behavior and more of genetically determined behavior than others. This is why an Eskimo infant and a Zulu infant, if exchanged at birth and each brought up in the home of the other, would become like the people of their respective foster homes in every way, except that they would retain the physical characteristics of their own race. These facts have important implications for problems involving race relations. Another basic distinction emphasized by anthropologists and contained within culture is the capacity for language. Though all animals communicate, only humans can communicate symbolically about something which is not present to the senses. Excuse me. Mankind alone can communicate about the abstract. Thus, we are able to accumulate knowledge by means of writing. In language, we have the key to communications concerning the past and the future. All other animals are limited in their communication to the here and now. It follows then that since there is no language common to the human species, at all comparable to the means of communication common to all members of every non-human species, it too is a part of culture. Symbolic cultural behavior then is the anthropological hallmark of mankind. Theological discussions of the image of God are also preoccupied with the distinctive attributes of mankind as compared with other animals. But whereas conventional anthropology limits human uniqueness to the cultural, biblical anthropology emphasizes the priority of the human spiritual nature, conceived as created, and in turn the logical creator of culture. Henry Van Til states the biblical position that man is a spiritual being. He is so constituted that he lives in a covenantal relationship to the Creator. His spirit transcends the physical and biological necessity and is the formative force that creates culture. Emil Brunner puts it this way: man is something other than the world, namely a spiritual being, and this is why he creates within it something which is other than the world, namely culture, the work of the mind and spirit. The biblical viewpoint is a theistic one, which must start with God, the Creator. The Christian anthropologist operating within the theistic worldview must then consider all humanity as creatures whose nature is, first of all, spiritual, although in a unified sense, also cultural and physical. For the Bible teaches that God not only creates the physical world, but that He also created the human part of it to be cultural as well as spiritual. It is my contention that it is within the cultural, spiritual nature of humanity that we should look for the identity of the image of God. Theologians, as well as scholars from other disciplines, when addressing themselves to human, non-human distinctions, often emphasize the biological-spiritual distinctions. Laboring over cultural attributes without the use of the term culture or cultural. Consequently, they fall into the habit of assigning some of the cultural attributes as functions of the spiritual nature, naming others which may be attributed to non-humans, and considering the matter of transcendence as practically total, as compared with non-human genetic determinism, with little regard for the subtleties or the intricacies of cultural determinism. Anthropologically speaking, too much of theological writing on the image of God has been rather naive regarding the created cultural limitations of human transcendence. There is a fair consensus that the image in question is not a physical one. Although C. Ryder Smith holds that the image included at least form, if not substance, here there is no doubt that the term describes something that could be seen. And David Carnes admits that it would not upset our view if there were also what we call physical overtones in the conception of Genesis 1:26. My objection would be simply in terms of a question. If there is anything visible or formal in the image of God in humanity, in which of the present races is it preserved? If it merely amounts to distinctive elements of human morphology, is it likely to degenerate into the irreverent observation that the image of God is the opposable thumb and the double-arched foot? Most statements proceed directly to a combination of spiritual, moral, and intellectual qualities. Gregory of Nyssa mentioned reason and thought. Augustine specified the mind and the rational or intellectual soul. James Orr emphasized rational and spiritual qualities and obedience to moral law. Buswell Jr. emphasizes the intellectual, moral, and spiritual mature nature. It emphasizes the intellectual, moral, and spiritual nature. Moray, man's knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. Bavinck, understanding, reason, and knowledge. And Sire, his intelligence and morality. Added to these qualities is a variety of other attributes, such as self-conscious, self-determining, self-awareness, mentioned in one form or another by the majority. Personality, Morai, Sire, Leach, Schaefer, personal agent, Orr, free agent, Hodge, creativity, Sire and Leach, gregariousness, Sire, and transcendence and dominion, or vice regency, Buswell Jr., mentioned in one form or another by the majority. Now, regarding reason or the rational nature, it has been demonstrated by the ethologists that non-human animals can behave in a rational manner. Therefore, conventional anthropology insists upon the implication that human rationality is best seen from an evolutionary standpoint as the end product of a continuity, even though this end product now constitutes what amounts to a difference in kind. But from a biblical perspective, rationality attributed to the image of God in humanity, as Reinhold Niebuhr has expressed it, must be understood primarily from the standpoint of God, rather than the uniqueness of man's rational faculties or his relation to nature. And what is ordinarily meant by reason does not imply spirit, but spirit does imply reason. Charles Hodge expressed the biblical theistic perspective in these words: God is a spirit. The human soul is a spirit. The essential attributes of a spirit are reason, conscience, and will. In making man after his own image, therefore, God endowed him with those attributes which belong to his own nature as a spirit. Again, human nature being a spiritual, cultural one, we must carefully specify the perspective from which these attributes are viewed. It is difficult to distinguish between reason implanted by God in humanity and manifest in human behavior, and genetically based reason in non-humans manifest in animal behavior, except in terms of the unique human capacity to talk about it. The same goes for non-human powers of abstraction and self-awareness. Humans cannot achieve the same degree of empathy with non-humans as they can with other humans. The method of participant observation is unavailable in the study of all but human subjects. Even for those who, through intimate familiarity and specialization, approximate empathy with and are tolerated by a non-human species, their interpretations of non-human motivation, preferences, feelings, perceptions, and processes of cerebration must be rendered anthropomorphically. In the final analysis, self-objectification and self-awareness may be defined as unique to humans only to the degree that humans cannot learn from non-humans what they think about and whether or not they may have their own species characteristic modes of rationality and self-awareness without abilities of symbolic communication. When it comes to the attributes of knowledge, intelligence, gregariousness, will, thought, and the like, these can hardly be said to be distinctive of humans unless carefully qualified, for instance, knowledge, as in Colossians 3, 9 and 10, and with righteousness and true holiness, Ephesians 4, 22 to 23, as Buswell Jr. points out, without which the Word of God would not come to us, John 10, 35, nor could we have communion with the Lord. This includes the entire rational and moral nature of man. In the same vein, Brunner writes, because God creates man as one who can hear his call and can answer it, he also creates him as a rational being. The reason is the organ of perception. Let us briefly refer back to the claims of rational, conventional anthropology. If the spiritual aspect of distinctively human nature is denied, the cultural is all that is left. But may we not say that the moral nature of the image is moral because it is spiritual, while it is manifested only in the cultural? If the view is a theistic one, the focus is upon a combined spiritual-cultural nature. But if the view is not a theistic one, the focus splits the image and rests only on the cultural that is left. The perspective from which morals, reason, knowledge, etc. are viewed makes all the difference in their limitations to the cultural realm or their assignment to the spiritual or supercultural realm as well. It is impossible to separate the two realms from a biblical perspective except by analytical abstraction. A major implication of the image of God in its cultural aspects is the character of human society. Since humans don't have genetically predetermined species-specific social behavior, as we have already pointed out, some regulatory mechanism must operate in place of the genetic. The anthropologist explains this in terms of the various aspects of social relationships, culturally defined, and reinforced by multiple reciprocal bonds and functional linkages. Fundamental to the whole structure are the obligations of individual to group and of individual to individual, generated by kinship or contract, tying each to each by loyalty or culturally structured coercion. According to David Carnes, Barth's idea was that when God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness," he meant that there should be in man a harmonious confrontation, his relationship to the woman, like that which exists in the Godhead. Here, Barth makes much of the fact that both in Genesis 1:26 and Genesis 5:2, the statement that man was created in God's image is coupled with the words, "Male and female created he them." Thus, by implication, at least from this, and more specifically in other passages, we may view Barth's interpretation of the image as including all that it is to be humanly social, including the bond of willing helpfulness to other humans, which is man's by nature. Reinhold Niebuhr and Brunner have each expressed this aspect of creation in terms of love. As Brunner put it, man cannot be man by himself. He can only be man in community. For love can only operate in community, and only in this operation of love is man human. Such theologically oriented views emphasize the sociological aspect of the image, but by implication only, a cultural one, too, insofar as the consideration is limited to humans. But the nature of the cultural dimension as such generally remains unelaborated. The burden of such interpretations rests upon the purely relational or societal aspect with its attendant interpersonal attitudes and responsibilities. The fact that this aspect of human nature is tied to a system of values, a symboling cultural system to which such societal behavior must conform, which is external to the individual, but found to be different in each society, is seldom, if ever, recognized in the theological specifications of the image of God, except in terms of the human power to create such systems. As we have mentioned above, it is more characteristic to jump from the biological directly to the spiritual, while the emphasis upon the societal in terms of community or relationship, while implying a limitation to human culture, seldom social behavior that would not also pertain to the lesser animals. Coupled with this, and derived from it, the tendency to contrast animal genetic or biological restriction with an exaggerated concept of human transcendence, freedom, and self-determination. Thus, Gregory Dix describes mankind as a creature of two worlds, the physical and the transcendent realm of freedom. Regarding this freedom, he says, man is a self-directing being. Within certain limits, he can choose his own ends, direct his own life, decide upon his own objectives. And this he does from within his own being. The certain limits, Dix allows, are not cultural limitations, but rather those pertaining more grossly to the species. We cannot decide to be stones or cows, and we cannot decide to live in our bodies indefinitely. He goes on to specify that, within these various limits, I can be, if I choose, an honest man or a rogue, a sober man or a drunkard, a thoughtful, ambitious, hardworking man, or a selfish, pleasure-loving man. In other words, although my decisions may be thwarted by forces both inside and outside myself, I have a real freedom to decide what I shall make of my manhood. Similarly, James Sire has recently written that each man reflects, as an image, the transcendence of God over his universe. In Sire's view, each, except in cases of extreme deprivation, a person is not forced to any necessary reaction. Step on my toe. Must I curse? I may. Must I forgive you? I may. Must I yell? I may. Must I smile? I may. What I do will reflect my character. But it is the I that will act, and not just react like a bell ringing when a button is pushed. In short, man has personality and is capable of transcending the cosmos in which he is placed. personality is the chief thing about man, as I think it is fair to say, is the chief thing about God, who is infinite in his personality and his being. The personality of man is grounded in the personality of man, of God. Excuse me. The personality of man is grounded in the personality of God. Omitted by statements like these is the God-created, uniquely human experience of enculturation, which is necessary to form the personality, necessary to limit the culturally prescribed expressions of character, necessary to specify the culturally allowed alternatives of personal choice, limiting human transcendence, contributing significantly to whether I forgive you or curse you, or you step on my toe, and contributing even more significantly and from outside by my own being, to the character of my ambition as selfish or otherwise. Richard Niebuhr recognizes this as the rights of the nature of a man's freedom, pointing out that the forms and attitudes of his mind which allow him to make sense out of the objective world have been given him by his culture. Addison Leach approximated the anthropologist's cultural expression of this as he listed communication and powers of abstraction as among the attributes of the image of God. And James Orr, nearly 70 years before, concluded that man, in virtue of this endowment, allying him with his maker, is, as the animals are not, capable of conceptual thought, of rational speech, of education. The recognition of the subtle nuances of the formative, directive, and behavior-channeling influences of this enculturative experience of every human, the formal institutional sequences of which we call education, is crucial also for an understanding of the controls God created for the expressions of human nature. Each of the non-human species has its own genetically based social structure, but for humanity, culturally based patterns of social structure constitute the only buffer between order and chaos. Brunner has pointed out that unless a person knows himself as a created being, he knows rather neither responsibility nor limitation. Thus, conventional anthropology, denying such creation, denies the existence of any inhibiting absolutes of value or morals. All are culturally relative. Thus, they know neither responsibility nor limitation except to their own particular culture. But as Reinhold Niebuhr has pointed out, any force in human life which tends to keep the self in a normal position of subordination to God and coordination with its fellows must be regarded as an element of health, without which life would become completely self-destructive. Without the permission of our spiritual natures in conformity with our normal position of subordination to God, we experience the greatest of difficulties maintaining proper coordination with our fellows. Nevertheless, for fallen humanity, no matter whether regenerated in Christ or not, the socio-cultural aspects with the unique symboling facility of language constituting the fullest expression of the spiritual image of God also constitutes God's intended created means for controlling of human society. In conclusion, the implications of the emphasis upon the extent to which cultural determinism limits human freedom are rather striking. For A, those who would argue in favor of throwing off all socio-cultural restraints in a demand for freedom, and B, for those who embellish humanity's transcendence over its biological nature with unwarranted dimensions of freedom. Both would seem to be, perhaps inadvertently, advocating a distinctly non-human condition. For the nature of humanity, from the biblical perspective, involves human culture in as vital a role as the human body or the human spirit. Thus endeth the